morning. So one of the things that I've had to deal with as a parent is that my daughter, MJ, is pretty courageous. She enjoys a lot of things that scared me when I was a child. For example, I was terrified of dogs as a kid. I liked them in theory, but they were loud and over-exuberant and not particularly gentle, and so I was pretty scared of them. MJ, on the other hand, does not mind if a dog runs up to her and barks loudly and licks her in the face. She's delighted by it, in fact. She doesn't enjoy it if they knock her over, but she gets over that pretty quickly. She really enjoys dogs. I also, as a kid, was pretty scared of heights. I'm still not a huge fan of them, but MJ is a climber. She's not even 1.5, and she just recently figured out that if she pulls the chairs out from the dining room table, she can climb up on the chair and then climb up on the table and stand on our dining room table. But we have discovered one thing that she is quite terrified of, and that's the vacuum cleaner. She doesn't like the loud noise it makes, and whenever we turn it on, she just weeps. It's kind of sad. So here's my question, though, for you. What are you afraid of? Whether or not we'd like to admit it, there's something that everyone's afraid of. We're all afraid of something, right? Sometimes our fears can be silly and irrational. For example, I'm afraid of carnivorous plants. I really am. They're creepy and disgusting, and I don't like that they exist. Thankfully, that doesn't affect me much in my day-to-day life, but please don't take advantage of this information to prank me. I won't appreciate it. But sometimes, you know, our fears can be irrational and silly. Sometimes they can be more serious. You don't need me to tell you that the year 2020 had a lot of fear in it. It's been a hard year. But even before this global pandemic struck, we all had our fears. Again, you know, though MJ is a courageous kid, I'm not a very courageous parent. And there's been a lot of things for me to be afraid of as a parent. I'm not particularly bothered by the vacuum cleaner. But when a barking dog runs up to MJ, I go into like parental protection mode, and I'm starting to wonder, do I need to kick this dog as it runs up to my daughter, or do I need to defend her or whatever? You know, I see her on the dining room table or halfway up the stairs, I have a bit of a panic attack. You know, or even that little face that she makes as she's choking on food, even for like the half a second before she coughs and it's okay, my heart starts racing in that moment. Or even, most of all, the thought of her being seriously hurt or worse, growing up not loving Jesus, just grips my heart with a fear that I don't know how to deal with sometimes. It gets my stomach in knots. What are you afraid of? Are you afraid of getting sick? Are you afraid of getting someone else sick? Are you afraid of losing your job or not being able to find a job? Or of rejection, or afraid of the things that you see in yourself and where they may lead you? How do we deal with fear as a Christian, as someone who follows God? That's the question that's addressed and answered in this passage that Sarah just read for us this morning. In this passage, we're going to meet some people who were gripped by powerful fear. And we're going to see how Jesus helped them through that fear. And as we look at this passage, we're going to see three realities about our lives. They're going to help us to challenge us and to teach us and to correct us as we to entrust our fears to Jesus. So again, we're in Luke chapter 8, starting in verse 40. And I'm going to read part of that again today. And as we do, we're going to see, first of all, the first reality about life that we see from this passage is that life will involve powerful fear. Life will involve powerful fear. That's part of life. So look again at Luke chapter 8, verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. The first fearful person that we meet in this story is a man named Jairus. Jairus was an elder among his people. He's a leader in the synagogue. So in his town, in his area, he has influence. He's a powerful man. He's the kind of man that can get what he needs when he needs to. But something's happening to him that's completely outside of his control. something that he cannot do anything about. His 12-year-old daughter is dying. She's his only child. He loves her. And she's dying. It's not just that she's really sick and he's afraid that she might die. The language in here tells us that she is literally in the process of dying. She's on death's doorstep. It's coming for her. And there's nothing he can do about it. You know, as a parent of a little girl, this passage hit me this time that I was looking at it differently than it has in the past. I can feel his fear as I think about this. I can't even imagine how scared Jairus must have been in that moment. And I'm not just projecting my emotions into the passage. Further down, we're going to see that Jesus speaks to Jairus' fear. He speaks in verse 50 and tells him not to be afraid. His only daughter is dying. She's only 12. She's barely started to live. And he can't help her. And he's terrified. But he knows that Jesus can help her. He's heard that Jesus can help her. And so Jesus, having shown the power over sickness and miraculous healings, Jairus throws himself down at Jesus' feet and pleads with him and begs him to come and help his daughter. And Jesus agrees, and they leave together. And on the way, we meet the second fearful person in this story. Look with me again at the second half of verse 42. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. But no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. So as they try to go to Jairus' house to help the daughter, there's a ginormous crowd around Jesus, and they're pushing in and pressing in against him. And so they have to kind of elbow their way through this crowd and push through to get to where they're going. And you can feel the anxiety of Jairus in this passage, not because, you know, it's COVID-19, there's no social distancing going on, but because he knows this is delaying them from getting home to his daughter. And as they're kind of moving through this crowd, all of a sudden Jesus stops and looks around and said, who touched me? And everyone's a bit confused. Everyone denies it. And Peter says, "Master, everyone's touching you. The crowd is crushing us. Like you're surrounded by people." And you can just, again, I can just feel Jairus's frustration. Like, what is the holdup? Like, let's go. Not because he's being impatient in a way that's inappropriate. I mean, if you're an ambulance rushing to the hospital to save somebody, you're not going to pull over for anything else, right? You're not going to stop along the way. But Jesus is adamant. Verse 46, he says, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out for me." And that's when this woman steps forward. She had been hiding and trying to go unnoticed, but she realizes she's not going to get away with it. She comes forward. And she admits to it. And she's scared. Verse 47 says, "The woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet." Why is she so scared? Well, it's because of her situation. We saw in verse 43 that we were told a woman who was there had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. When she came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. So this woman has been suffering from bleeding. In other words, she's had a hemorrhage in her uterus for 12 years. She's been bleeding slowly for all these years. The other gospels tell the same story, tell us that she's gone to doctors and she's spent all of her money on them, and she's actually ended up worse than when she started. The doctors mangled her, didn't help, they made it worse. But Luke, being a physician himself, leaves that detail out. And so she's desperate. And here's why she's afraid. Not just because she's got a serious medical condition. She did, right? She would be sort of weak from blood loss all the time, in serious danger of dying if she wasn't keeping up her nutrition and sort of trying to maintain and take care of herself. That's a serious reality for her. Not only is it that, not only is there kind of an awkward part about day-to-day life that she has to deal with, but for her as an Israelite, as a Jewish woman, under the Old Testament law, she was actually ceremonially unclean. In the Old Testament law, as many of you know, there's a section on ritual purity or ceremonial cleanness. And the part that we're most familiar with is the whole kosher food law, right? We talked about last week that with the pigs, that eating pork as a Jewish person, and there's a whole bunch of other things, shellfish and other kind of animals that you can't eat as a Jewish person. It makes you ceremonially unclean. And this idea of being ceremonially unclean means that you're not able to enter into the worship of God at the temple. It cuts you off from doing that if you've done these things that have made you ceremonially unclean. But beyond the food laws, there's a whole section in there where, as we read it today, they seem very strange and even unfair to us. But all of these restrictions, if you read through Leviticus and Numbers and see these parts, have to do with a reminder for us as humans that we are not like God. That we are mortal and weak, and that we are born and we live and we die, and that our life has a span, and we are not like the immortal God who was never born and who never died. And so there's a large section in here of these purity laws that has to do with death and decay, right? If you touch a dead body, you're ceremonially unclean. If your house has mold in it or you have an infectious skin disease, you're ceremonially unclean. But on the other end of it, anything that has to do with childbirth or procreation also makes you unclean. So as a woman who gives birth, you're unclean for a period of time. Through menstruation, through emission of reproductive fluids, those things, they make you unclean. And whatever side of the spectrum we're talking about, usually there's a period of time after which these things happen when you are unclean, then you go through a ritual, and then you are clean again, and you're able to enter into the worship of God. And it was just a reminder as a part of life, as you become unclean, that you are not like God. But if you have a chronic problem, like this woman does, a chronic skin disease or a chronic hemorrhage, it means that you're perpetually unclean. You're just unclean all the time. And so this woman for 12 years has been cut off from the worship of God at the temple. But the other reality that she had to deal with is that uncleanness, ceremonial uncleanness, ritual impurity, is a contagious condition. If I'm unclean and I touch anything or you, that thing or that person becomes unclean by contact. And so this woman has not only been cut off from the worship of God at the temple for 12 years, but she's been socially isolated for 12 years. I mean, we know a little bit about just a piece of what that's like, right? She has been not able to be in contact with people for 12 years. And yet, when she knows that Jesus is in town, she braves this crowd to go to him, right? And so the reason that she's afraid is because she's elbowed her way through a crowd and touched dozens of people who are now also unclean, and if they know, will be very angry with her. And then she's had the audacity to go and touch a religious leader, a holy man, a prophet of God, as she understands. And she just doesn't want people to know that she's done that. She's rightly afraid of the anger and the rejection that she's going to experience from people when they know who she is and what she's done. So she's trembling. And here's the point of all of this. Jairus and this woman are right to be afraid. Their situations absolutely justify fear. The fear of devastating loss, the fear of societal shame and rejection. These are serious, powerful fears that are just a normal part of life. I want to make it clear to you that just because you may be afraid doesn't mean that you're sinning when you are. Fear is a part of life. In fact, God designed fear as a natural response, a physiological response to dangerous and stressful situations that help us to react in healthy ways. But fear can become disordered and be unhealthy too. Fear can overwhelm us and cause us to react poorly, to freeze and not react at all. It can have too much power in our lives. And that's when it really becomes a problem. Jairus and this woman, they're not condemned for their fear. The Bible doesn't belittle the reality that powerful fear is part of life. But what it does is it presents an even more powerful reality that we need to remember in the face of fear. Whether it's disordered fear or normal fear, we need to remember this reality to help us to cope with it. And that reality that we're going to see is that Jesus has powerful love, right? We've seen that life has powerful fear in it sometimes, but now we're going to see that Jesus has powerful love. So look again at verse 47. We'll start at the beginning of the verse. Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, this is what she did not want to do. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." The woman comes forward. She's trembling. She falls at his feet and she fesses up. She admits what she's done and how it worked. She was immediately healed. This problem that she's had for 12 years is gone. And Jesus is not upset. Jesus is not angry with her. Jesus doesn't say, "How dare you touch me?" Jesus looks at her and says gently, and I imagine crouching down to see her and with a smile on his face, that's just my imagination, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." But notice he doesn't just say, "You're healed, go in peace." Notice what he calls her. He calls her daughter. Now, that can be something that we could easily gloss over, but think about the situation, right? It's not culturally inappropriate in this time, this place, for an older gentleman to call a younger woman daughter, right? You know, nation of Israel, they had a familial, we are all part of the same family, the people of God, and the older men could call the younger woman daughter, and that was normal. But Jesus is in his early 30s, and this woman's been sick for 12 years, so it means if she's younger than him, she barely is. It wouldn't have been noticeable anyway, and more likely she's older than him. So why is Jesus calling her daughter? Well, you know, we know Jesus is really God, and God is older than everyone, and God created everyone, and specifically those who come to him in faith are his children, right? So it can be easy to kind of, I know that. But don't gloss over that information as unimportant. Because Luke actually, when he writes this story down, he writes it in a way that draws these details out and shows their significance. Because the story starts with a man who's terrified for the life of his daughter. And you read it and you can't help but feel how much love and compassion and concern he has for her. And you read that this daughter is 12 years old. And then this story is interrupted by this other woman who's been suffering for 12 years. And, you know, any reader who reads that is like, oh, it's the same number. You can't help but notice that, right? And then when Jesus uses the same word to talk to her as Jairus talks about his daughter, we see in here that Jesus, when he sees this woman, she's not just an interruption or a distraction to him. He loves her just as much as Jairus loves his daughter. So all of the joy and the fatherly pride and the compassion and the concern that Jairus has for his natural-born daughter, Jesus feels that for this woman. Every bit as much. You know, in the Bible, God calls us in different places. He calls his people both his bride and his children, right? God calls us those two things. And it's really amazing that he uses that terminology for us. Because my whole life, you know, I've loved people. I love my parents and my siblings, and I have friends that I love. But it wasn't until I got married and then had a daughter myself that I really started to understand the intensity of those relationships. Right? The love that I have for my wife and my daughter bowls me over all the time. Just wells up sometimes. I'm like, wow, my life is so good. And God loves me like that, but so much more, right? The love that I have for my wife and my daughter is a shadow of the love that God has for me. His love for me is, you know, intense like that. I mean, and again, as loving my wife and loving my daughter, there's an intensity that are different from each other. There's different aspects of that love. And God loves me and you in that way, only more purely and more faithfully and more powerfully. There's nothing lacking in his love for you. Jesus calls you daughter, calls you son. He says, I love you. Whether or not you feel that to be true, it is. He loves you so much. He has a powerful love for you, but his love for you is powerful in another way. It's not just a powerful feeling of love, it's a love that has power to it. MJ maybe thinks that I'm the biggest, strongest man in the world. She has this new thing where she likes to feel my muscles, but usually it's at my wrist where there's no muscle at all. But I'm not the biggest, strongest, most powerful man even in this room, let alone the world. But if I was the most physically strong man in the world, and also, let's put in there, the smartest man in the world, the richest man in the world, and the most politically powerful man in the world, my power would still have limit. There would only be so much that I'd be able to do for her in my love. Like Jairus wasn't able to help his daughter when she was dying, my power and my love for my daughter would have a limit. But that's not the case with Jesus. Jesus has power without limit. Look at verse 49. Look what happens next. While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, a synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." While Jesus is talking to this woman, and Jairus is agonizing over the delay, his worst fears are realized. Someone comes from his house and says, "It's too late. You didn't make it. Your daughter's died. I can't even begin to imagine how his life imploded in on him in that moment. Unfortunately, I know some of the people that are listening to this can. Some of you can. You've experienced things like this. He's out there. His daughter's sick, but Jesus is coming. There's hope. And then that hope just gets shut off. And the world's still going on. The birds are still singing. The sun is still shining. The crowd is still there making noise and amazed at what Jesus has done. But for him, there's just darkness and hollow agony. Not even Jesus can help anymore, he thinks. And this man says as much. Don't bother him. He let him go help somebody he can help. But Jesus doesn't agree. Verse 50 says, "Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, 'Don't be afraid. Just believe and she will be healed.'" And I can't even begin to fathom what's going through Jairus' head at this moment as he walks with Jesus to his house, sees his wife who's shattered, makes eye contact with her, and they come in together. But look at what Jesus does in verse 51. "When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her." "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She's not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Jesus comes with Jairus and his disciples to the house, is surrounded by the people that are mourning. That's just part of their cultural way of dealing with death, is they would have a period of loud, emotional mourning where people that knew them would come and just wail and cry outside the house. Jesus says, "Guys, stop. She's not dead. She's just sleeping." And they laugh because they know that she is dead, right? Her heart has stopped. Her breathing is done. We're even told in verse 50 that her spirit has left her body. So Jesus' point here seems to be, this isn't a permanent situation. This isn't death. She's going to come back from this. She's going to get up in a minute. So Jesus takes these poor parents and three of his disciples, Peter and John and James, into the house, and he grabs the little girl by the hand, which again, Jewish law, he's now ceremonially unclean if he was a normal person, touching a dead body. And he says, "Child, get up." And what's incredible about this, besides the fact that a girl comes back from the dead, is that it's not just like a slow waking up and she's still kind of sick and needs to be healed. You know, she wakes up and jumps out of bed like a kid on Christmas morning. Like, just immediately she gets up. And then, again, Luke being a physician, he adds these details to remind us, like, this is real. This really happened and she's healthy. Jesus says, go get her something to eat, right? She's not a sickly kid. She's got an appetite. She's doing well. She's up and running around. I don't know if she was doing cartwheels like the video showed, but, you know, she's great. That's the power of the love of Jesus. That's the power that Jesus has without limit. Over the past couple of weeks, we've seen these stories that are kind of grouped together in the Gospel of Luke that have shown the power and authority that Jesus has in a number of ways. We've seen his power and authority over nature as he calms the raging storm and saves people from the raging sea. We've seen his power and authority over the supernatural as he casts a literal army of demons out of a man. We've seen his power and authority over the human body and over sickness as he heals this woman who the doctors couldn't help. And now, a step even beyond those things, we see the power and authority of Jesus over death itself as he raises a little girl back to life in a moment. You know, there's something, as incredible as all those stories are, there's something about this raising someone from the dead that's just a step beyond, right? Because as you know, frail mortal humans, as we talked about, you know, they had to go through these ceremonial cleanness things to remind them of that. But we know that we're mortal when we face death, right? If somebody is sick, there's still hope for them. If somebody is in a storm, there's still hope for them. We make movies as humans about the triumph of the human spirit over these kinds of things. If somebody is oppressed by evil, they didn't know how to help him, but he was still alive. There was still hope for them. But when someone dies, that hope seems to be gone. Their story is over. There's nothing else to do except mourn. Right? Death is the end of the story for humanity. It comes often abruptly and far too soon. It's always sad, even when it's not far too soon. It's hard, it's difficult, and it seems to be the end of hope, but that's not true with Jesus. He has authority over death. He has power to restore life and bring hope that cannot and does not die. Death is the one enemy that is mortal humans. We cannot hope to defeat ourselves, but he defeated it. Jesus, who loves us so powerfully, has power without limit to help us and to bring us hope. That is who Jesus is. And so there's a third reality that comes as a result of that. We've seen that powerful fear is part of life. We've seen that Jesus has powerful love. But the third reality that we're going to see is that what we're called to do is a response. We're called to have faith. We're called to have faith. The way that we overcome powerful fear is by coming to Jesus who has powerful love and coming to him with faith. Notice I didn't say powerful faith because it doesn't need to be powerful faith. We can come to Jesus with faith that is weak and unsure and barely hanging on, because what saves us and what gives us hope is not the strength of our faith, but the strength of the one that we put our faith in. When this woman who had this problem of bleeding came to Jesus, she didn't come with confidence and not caring what people thought. She was hiding and trembling, but she did it anyway because she trusted that Jesus was her hope. He's the one who could help her. And so Jesus says to her in verse 48, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. And when Jesus says in verse 50 to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe, same word, have faith, and she will be healed. Do you think Jairus' response was, oh, great, okay. No way. Jairus had no idea what to think. He was terrified still. And when he and his wife saw Jesus raise their daughter from the dead, it says that they were astonished in verse 56. They didn't know what to expect. They were just following Jesus with a little bit of faith that they could hold on to. When Becky turns on the vacuum cleaner, and yes, she is the one who regularly vacuums. I do other things. Don't worry, it's fair. but when she turns on the vacuum cleaner, and MJ starts weeping, she does something interesting. You might expect that she runs in the opposite direction and hides from the sound of the vacuum cleaner. But she doesn't. She runs to Becky and wants to be held, even though Becky has the vacuum cleaner. She's running towards the thing that's scaring her. Because she knows at the bottom of everything, she can trust her mom. And she's safe with her mom. And so when Becky's holding her, she feels better. It doesn't mean she's not scared anymore. It doesn't mean she's not weeping anymore. She still hates that vacuum cleaner. But at the bottom of it all, she knows I'm safe in my mom's arms. That is a great picture of what faith is all about. When we run to Jesus, we don't have to know that everything's going to be fine. We don't have to know what's going to happen. We can still run to him and say, Jesus, I'm still scared. I don't get it. I don't know why you're letting this happen to me. But I know that I can trust you. I know that you love me and you're powerful and I just have to have faith in you and I'm here with you. But here's the question that we need to ask ourselves. What exactly are we trusting Jesus for? What do we mean when we say we believe that he'll take care of us? Because lots of people who trust God get chronically ill and never experience relief. Even the Apostle Paul talks about that at some level in the New Testament. Lots of people who trust God have experienced great loss and even the death of a child. It's not that they were not faithful enough or not trusting God enough that God did that. It's just not how it works. Every single person alive who trusts God will die unless Jesus comes back first. That is just the way it's going to go. So what do we say, or what do we mean when we say we can trust Jesus to take care of us? What do we even mean by that? Well, this story ends with a really interesting twist. The very last sentence. Look at verse 56. Jesus raises this girl from the dead. She gets up, gets her something to eat. And then in verse 56, her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Now, I have no idea how you downplay the fact that your child died and rose back to life. I don't know how you do that at all. But Jesus says, I don't want people having their attention drawn to this. I don't want you to tell people what I've done. Why not? Well, it's for the very same reason that Jesus doesn't want people knowing who he is yet. In the very next chapter, in chapter 9, Peter announces, Jesus, I know that you are the Messiah. You are the promised king that God was good to send to save the people from oppression and punish the guilty, punish the wicked, judge sin, and set up God's kingdom. I know that that's who you are. And Jesus' response is, great, don't tell anyone. Why not? Because Jesus has different mission and a different priority than the people realize that he does. The people think Jesus is the king who's come to free us from oppression and judge those wicked Romans, and he has the power to raise people from the dead. I am all in for this war, right? Like, I don't care. This is the greatest army in the world, the Roman army. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of troops who are well-trained and have crazy armor. It doesn't matter. If I die, he just raises me back to life and we keep going. Like, it's good. We don't need to worry about this. And that's exactly what Jesus is trying to avoid. He says, that's not my mission. In that chapter, chapter 9, after Peter says, I know that you're the Messiah, and Jesus says, don't tell anybody, he follows up in verse 22 by saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and the teachers of the law, and he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. He says, Peter, I'm not going to be accepted by the leaders of this people. I'm not going to lead an army to defeat the Romans and kill them and bring war. I'm going to be rejected, and I'm going to be killed. And then I'm going to be raised to life. And he says, you think that my role is to bring war with the wicked. My role isn't to kill the wicked, it's to be killed for the wicked. And to bring peace, not just to the people of Israel who are ethnically Jewish, but to bring peace to everyone who comes to me in faith. My role isn't just to defeat death, that is, if you die, to raise you back up to the same life you had before so that you'll die again. My mission is to break the power of death once and for all through my death and resurrection. When the woman comes to Jesus, in verse 48, he says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Through faith, she's been healed, and she can be at peace, and that's true at a physical level, but more importantly, it's true at a spiritual level. The word for healed, in Greek, it's the same word as the word for saved. So you've been saved. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace with God. When we have faith in Jesus, we can trust that we have peace with God. Our own sin, our wickedness, does not make us enemies of His anymore. We are secure in His love and in His power, and He'll never let us go. And that means that even if we do suffer in this world, and we will, even when we're afraid, even when we're going through hardship, we can believe that we haven't lost the love of God because we know that God came to suffer for us. Jesus came and suffered in our place the worst suffering that we ever could. And so when we know that that's true, everything that we face, we can say, I know that He hasn't abandoned me. I don't get it. I don't know why it's happening. And I'm crushed by this. I'm struggling with this. But my hope is still in the fact that the love of Jesus has not failed. Because I know that He suffered in my place on the cross and took the punishment for my sins. And even when we face death, we know that we face death as a defeated enemy. An enemy that in the long run, has no teeth. Because our Savior broke the power of sin and death. So that death is no longer the end of hope. Jesus died and rose again, not just so that when we die, He can raise us up to the same mortal, corrupted life that we had before. He died and rose again so that one day we who put our faith in Him can be risen to new life like Jesus was. This little girl who was raised again, she died again. She's been dead for a long time. But if she had faith in Jesus and knew who He was, then one day she will be raised once again like Jesus was. Her old body that was corrupted by sin and sickness will be done away with and made new like Jesus' new body. So there's no more corruption by mortality. She will be raised immortal and free from sin and sickness and sorrow. And that is the hope that all who put their faith in Jesus have. And if you're here and you've never put your faith in Christ, you know maybe even that He died and rose again, but it's never been something that's given you hope. Never been something that you say, my sin is taken care of. My life is secure in Him. You can do that right now. Just put your faith in Him and say, Jesus, You're my Lord. You're the one that I have hope in. And I'm going to turn from my old ways and live for You now. And you can experience this hope and this powerful love through whatever faith you're able to offer up to Him. And if we have put our faith in Jesus, if we say, I know these things are true and they are important in my life, the question that's left for us is, what are you afraid of? What are the things that make your heart race, that keep you up at night, that give you anxiety? Leave it with him. Just leave it with him. Don't let your fear paralyze you and prevent you from obeying him. Don't let it overwhelm your life. Leave it with him. Whatever you're facing, he loves you. As our benediction today, I want to read a passage from Romans chapter 5 that speaks about this. Let me read this to you and then we'll close. Romans chapter 5, starting at verse 1, says, "Therefore, since we have been justified, that is, declared innocent of our sins by God, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into his grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, and perseverance produces character, and character hope, and hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through his Holy Spirit, who has been given to us." You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will someone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. May this truth be our foundation this week. As we face the realities of life, the fears of life, may we remember the hope that we have because of Jesus' death and resurrection, his great and powerful love, which is there for us. May God bless you this week.